Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Home Companion, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so, hour and a half. I'm Graham, of course, and I'm looking forward to, it's been a while since we've been together, and you know, whenever that happens, our regular time together is fluctuates and changes all over the place, and it's because I'm gallivanting, as my grandmother would say. I'm gallivanting around the countryside, visiting you. We have an interesting program. This is the 7th of April, 2013, when we're going live. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is the 97th day of the year. Now, I know the celebrations, the preparations are starting around here for the summer solstice, and I imagine, you know, it goes without saying that you're getting your bacchanalian reveries are going to be ramped up, and if they're not, well, let me inspire you. 21st of June at 5:04 in the morning, the longest day and shortest night, and so much of what we are in terms of our culture is a product of the thread of the celebration of the sun returning. And going. Since I've last spoken to you, I've had some more wonderful conversations. I was doing a reading of the ancient charges at Corona Lodge in Berks Falls just the other night, and had the wonderful pleasure of meeting a Huguenot, one of the Protestant, you've heard me talk about the Huguenots, the Protestant group that was purged out of France. And because of that, it's back in the areas, you know, in the 17th century. Because of that, we were, by one event to another, able to have the assistance of Jean Dussolier, who helped James Anderson. And some, like me, would say that perhaps he was the genius behind the first constitution, but nevertheless, we give it to the, Anderson's got to be given credit for something, so somebody's got to write it. So let's keep Dussolier in the background. In true Masonic fashion, I might add, it's hard to, you know, to discover these fellows that linger in the shadows making decisions, but they are the essence of Freemasonry. I say to anyone far and wide, watch, pay attention. The glad handers and the people that are out there doing what is so common in society aren't really adding it much to the Masonic context. And in my estimation, the Masonic context is something I want to talk to you about today, of course. I hope you've tucked into the episode information. And I really am notorious to put down these, jot down the ideas so that I can capture them and develop them. And then I end up running. And man, you know, how in the world do I get around to sending that out on time and getting it edited in good shape? Anyway, all of that aside, this is another famous day. We're going to talk a bit more about. I'm about to reveal a secret. So, you know, I'm so good at revealing secrets about anything. So if you're salivating, looking for the secrets of masonry, it rests in the heart of each one of the masons that are joining us today. And if you're not, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have embraced the ethos of Freemasonry. It's just that, like any of us, our human development is transcendent. And it is a human characteristic. This is not a bank or a reservoir. We don't have a great thick wall with the haves and the haves and have nots. This is about breaking down those walls, breaking down those barriers so that they become veils of understanding, semi-permeable veils of understanding. They're translucent, sometimes opaque, sometimes not. It's about understanding. It's not about a programmed way of thinking about life and the world. Nothing to do with that. So for anybody listening in, you each have experiences that are unique. And let's just label your experiences, the wonderful experiences that make you who you are, that help you to move through your daily routine with vigor, that give you fill in your character, are the things that are the greatest secrets of all. So I'll come back and talk to you a bit later about the random acts of Masonic kindness, especially to strangers, and especially if they don't know that you were the one behind it. Those are the very sweetest of all. And those are the sweets that I encourage. They're completely healthy for your diet. Now, today is like every other day. It's a remarkable. We want to talk about some of the things that, we'll talk about the art history timeline, don't we? Primarily because we were generated by notions of arts and sciences, and I'm eager to talk to you about that today. I have some readings to share with you. More about truly getting into an understanding, doing credit to some of the authors around us. I tire of people that have ripped through material. I have young fellows actually bragging how quickly they've gone through something. And what can I tell you? I don't want to do things quickly. I want to savor things. I don't want to gulp that glass of Merlot. I want to savor it with your company. I want to listen to the intonation of Beethoven. I don't want to put it on fast. I don't want life on fast forward. So when I'm studying and understanding something, I want to implore you that if you're rushing, you're missing. There you go. How big of me to say that. If you're rushing, pay attention. The sense of time is all that you're playing with. It's not knowledge. This isn't a competition about who could jam more experiences into a life and say that, oh, gee, that's winning. That's the better. It's like saying, if I don't have any sense of what you appreciate in life and only can put blinkers on and say, well, you know, I've skied the Atlantic behind a powerboat, and I've climbed the major mountains of the world, that somehow that makes me different or more exciting or more of something than you. How meager of me to even try that. And how ridiculous of anybody to try and convince thoughtful men of such folly. But there you have it's not necessarily young men or old. People buy into it. And at the end of the day, if getting to the top of the mountain is what defines them, then God bless them. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. But if being thoughtful through their life or embracing the sense of struggle and gradual development is what helps them reach the top of that mountain, then bless him and her too. We've passed an auspicious week. Martin Luther King was assassinated this week. The day before he was assassinated, he spoke, gave the famous lecture from the mountaintop. You'll Google that and have a chance to savor something truly expressive of the human condition. He spoke at the Memphis Masonic Temple, gave that lecture. The next day, Martin Luther King was assassinated. We have so many good people in the world that we can afford to assassinate them, can't we? That's why it's important for the likes of good meaning people to remind each other that we are the predominant force of the world, as so many of the warrior societies are finding out. They're men and women coming back from the battlefront are now killing themselves in greater numbers than are being killed on the battles. Maybe we're figuring it out again that that the sword doesn't really accomplish a whole lot. Wanted to learn a little bit about art history? There you go. Stone Age, art history. 30,000 BC to 2500 BC. We had, of course, cave paintings about fertility goddesses and megalithic structures. What could be more important, I guess, if survival depended clearly on, as it does today, although we've stuck our head in the sand, the men and women, the families that are farming and producing, provide the meals. Without that, we don't exist. So if we're bright enough not to, we're so clever that we can tinker with the laboratory that creates that balance, careful balance of life. You know, we've got the Goldilocks planet here just right, or, you know, everything's just right for existence here. Water, air, food. So the Ice Age that ended 10,000 BC to 8,000 BC wasn't that long ago. And the new Stone Age and first permanent settlements were showing up about 8,000 BC to 2500 BC. That's Stone Age. All right, maybe I can't throw a rock back that far, but we're learning more about those men and women. And then, yeah, you don't have women, you don't have much. As some of the patriarchal societies are finding out, let's get rid of our little girl babies, because we need little boy babies, totally. And where are you today? All right, I'm going to whisper this out loud. You're screwed. <You've> been... I'm laughing ironically. What in the hell? What have you been thinking, boys? Getting rid of, you know, gender selection. If this happens in Canada, we should. This better not be happening around us. I tell you, you'll give your head a shake. But if those countries, those meager minds want to live with, you know, they don't want to get married, they don't want to date, hey, as their choice, but don't bring that show here. Please, that is not enlightened. That is complete tripe. Mesopotamian area, 3500 to 539 BC. That's where we had warrior art. Remember, this is a history of art. And a narration in stone relief. You know, it's like, oh, what are we going to do here? What's going on out there? Well, we've got warriors now. Let's make a picture of them and stick it on the wall. Sumerians invented writing. That's 3400 BC. And Hammurabi wrote his law code in 1780 BC. And Abraham founded monotheism, worship of the one. Well, we'll give him credit. I don't know. It could have been Ted or Bob. Okay, we've got to give somebody credit. Or not. The Egyptians came along after that. You wonder where they were. 3100 BC to 30 BC. And art took on a flavor of the afterlife, necromancy, pyramids, and tomb painting. Remind me to talk with, I have some questions for you about necromancy and Freemasonry that we should probably get into. Maybe with a glass of single malt and scratch our heads and wonder, hey, what up with that, as the kids would say. Imhotep, Step, Pyramid, Great Pyramids, the Bust of Nefertiti. Those are the great works. Historically, Narmer united Upper and Lower Egypt. That was pretty important. And that was in 3100 BC. And Ramesses II battled the Hittites. And the woman that is quite famous, Cleopatra, had died in 30 BC. And then we scoot ahead to the Greek and Hellenistic period. We've spoken at different times about the advantages and the teachings of the Greeks, as in Pythagoras, as in, Stoicism, the Stoics, the Epicureans, and the way of thinking. Greek idealism, this is around 850 BC to 31 BC. Balance of perfect proportions, architectural orders, the Doric, Ionic, Corinthian. No, there wasn't a composite, but, they never stopped us before. Oh, my goodness, go out and find one. I'm just saying. The Parthenon was built. I was talking to my younger brother who built a house. It's just gorgeous. And he was talking, we were looking at this line. It was just a planking on the floor. And he said that he had to eyeball it because, just all the angles, everything that made it square didn't work. So I have a visitor. So he eyeballed it, and I was telling him, talking with him, because we had the Parthenon the same. The boy said, well, if we put everything square on that, it just looks like, it doesn't work, boys. So they said, never mind, put that thing away. We're just going to eyeball her. And proportionally, it just works, doesn't it? When you look at it, perspective. This is when Athens defeated Persia at Marathon in 490. Get into that. Oh, a part I want to encourage you to get into, because I don't know enough about it, and if you're an expert, then you can sit down with me and teach me about it, is the Peloponnesian Wars, 431 BC to 404. And then after that, that Johnny-come-lately, what was his father's name? The Persian king. Alexander the Great was born. And he had Greek scholars, Socrates as his mentor. And he started the conquest. He was around between 336 BC and 323. And don't let that, I'm not so much interested in Alexander the Great. We know a little bit about him. Family problems, lots of family problems. But I will be asking for your help about the Peloponnesian Wars. Now we get the Romans. And Romans, interesting folks. Left us all kinds of information that we used. They're 500 BC to 476 AD. Did you know that they banned groups larger than 9 people getting together? Now, you might want to ask yourself, why? Well, they're an interesting bunch. 10 produces a rabbi. 10 Jews together, one becomes a rabbi. Rabbis are generally, I would say, from the people that I've had the pleasure of meeting, are learned people, very thoughtful, very learned. I don't mean that they're just benign but this is about passing on knowledge and keeping the bar very high. So they banned associations of more than 9. So that way there was never a rabbi in Judaism. It challenged the root of Judaism. Is that a little bit sinister? For me, it is. That was when the arts took on a feeling of the Roman realism and practical and down to earth. And the arch was, very, very important architecturally. Augustus of Prima Porta, the Colosseum was built, Trajan's Column, and the Pantheon was built. 44 BC, Julius Caesar was assassinated. Augustus was proclaimed emperor in 27 BC. And then in Diocletian split the empire in 292 AD. And then, of course, Rome fell in 476 AD. Now, my, oh my, where in the world were the Indian, Chinese, and Japanese? 653 BC to 1900. Serene, meditative art, and the arts of the floating world. Gu Keishi, Li Chen, Gaoqi, Hakusei, Hiroshi. These are the movements. Birth of the Buddha in 563 BC. The Silk Road opened in the first century. Buddhism spread to China in the first and second centuries from Japan. And it spread to Japan, or spread to China and Japan in the fifth century. Now, following that, of course, is the Byzantine and the Islamic movements, faiths, processes, I would say faiths, 476 AD to 1453. Heavenly Byzantine mosaics, Islamic architecture, an amazing maze-like design. People that revered the purity of God, that we should not attempt to portray God in human form because it was greater. Idealistic, but a purity that's really a remarkable. Hagia Sophia, the big, big, big library, huh? In Constantinople. Andrei Rublev and the mosque at Cordoba. So this is the Justinian party restores Western Roman Empire. You know, you wonder, where were those after they fell apart? 476, was it going to lie down? No. Iconoclasm, controversy began in 726 to 843, birth of Islam in 610, and the Muslim conquests, so-called, 632 to 732. You and I will start to get into it, and now you've been around some lodges, you'll have seen fellows sitting there that were can explain what it was like back in the Middle Ages, because they were there, at least from the amount of dust on them. Middle Ages, 500 to 1400. That's where we saw Celtic art. Carolingian Renaissance and Romanesque Gothic periods. And the important movements were St. Cernan, the Durham Cathedral, Notre Dame, Chartres, Cimabue, Duccio, and Giotto. And this is when we saw experienced Viking raids, 793 to 1066, the Battle of Hastings in 1066, important if you're a Brit. Crusades between the first, number one to four, that was between 1095 and 1204. Lots of reality coming out about the Crusades, and curious event, eh? And of course, the scourge of on humanity, the Black Death, between 1347 and 1351. And then the Hundred Years' War. All interesting period. Interesting historically. 1337. Plug that in and look at the Hundred Years' War. Fascinating part. And I am going to come back about the Peloponnesian War. So, yeah, get your list. And then we had the early and high Renaissance period between 1400 and 1550. This is the rebirth of classical culture. Ghiberti's Adores. Check that out. Fascinating. Donatello, Botticelli. Whoa, the work is just, and Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Raphael. This, what do you say? Again, an ability to move our understanding of the human condition beyond words. Gutenberg invented movable type in 1447. Really interesting leading up to how that happened, because all of the bits and pieces had been invented earlier, but this was the guy that was able to pull it all together. It needed ink, it needed paper, it needed the press. There was a lot of things that had to be developed. The Turks conquered Constantinople in 1453, and Columbus landed in the New World. And please, I am not going to insult you by saying there was discovery there, okay? 1492. And this is when Martin Luther started the Reformation, 1517. Perhaps a repulsion against the opulence, the symbol of the church of the day. And then we go on to Venetian and Northern Renaissance in 1430 to 1550, the same period as early and high Renaissance, but the Renaissance spread northward to France and the Low Countries, Poland, Germany, and England. Interesting history of Poland. The kings of Poland. We'll talk about that in a little while. I'm getting through some material by Catherine and Polemkin. And I wanted to, when I have enough that I can speak with some modicum of intelligence about it, I'll talk to you a bit about the history. This is the period of Bellini. Oh, the melodic. Check out the Bellini opera Norma about the Druid Queen. But find a nice warm day where you're not going to be troubled greatly, and sit with put a book up in front of you and a nice glass of wine, and just be prepared to be transcended. It is just a wonderful story about a daughter and a mother and love and betrayal, all the things that make great opera, but so melodic. And this is also the period of Grigioni and Titian and Dürer, the famous watercolorists, to the Bruegel and Bosch, Jan van Eck and Roger van der Weyden. And this is also the period of the Council of Trent and the Counter-Reformation between 1545 and 1563. And my, oh my, Copernicus proved that the Earth revolves around the sun, 1543. And we know what happened to him. Don't be too uppity there, Copernicus. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you've got the facts, but you're a little bit uppity, and we don't agree with all of that uppity science stuff, you know. We started to see before that, you know, there was a day when science and faith, religion, were one. And no, we had to go muck it around until it's the sort of dog's dinner that it is today, sadly. And then we have something, a movement that some of you may not be familiar with, called Mannerism. And this is between 1527 and 1580. And it was art that breaks the rules. Artifice over nature. And this is El Greco, the Greek. Pontormo and Bronzini and Cellini. This is the period when Magellan circumnavigated the globe, 1520 to 1522. And then a period that it causes me to go to places. Here it is. Listen to this. That's a sonata number 5. Anyway, this is the Baroque period, 1600 to 1750. This is the music that I listen to before I start the programs. This is a splendor and flourish for God. Art as a weapon in the religious wars. This is the period of Rubens and Rembrandt, Caravaggio, and the Palace of Versailles. This is the 30-year wars between Catholics and Protestants, 1618 to 1648. Please at least consider that these were powerful influences on the boys that created this notion of the Grand Lodge. Of course, how could it not? We had been through the period of the Civil War in Britain. We had been through, 1611, beheaded the king. And 11 years, 1643. And then 11 years later, his son was put on the throne again when the country realized that they really couldn't move without some form of understandable, recognizable leadership. And we're fortunate, I guess, in so many ways that that Cromwell left us with the new army, didn't he? For the very first time, the twits weren't in charge. They actually had professionals, people that knew what they were doing, were put in charge of the army. And that, you know, it's strayed a little bit. As we know, the First World War, we see some examples of, you know, people that were poorly trained but had the rank. Oh my, is that a leap or a segue into masonry if I've ever heard one? I can't take credit. People being in positions of influence over people's lives that over the top, boys, and God bless you, you're going to die. Anyway, the neoclassical period came up, followed that, 1750 to 1850. And that was when art recaptured the Greco-Roman grace and grandeur. And David and Ingres and Canova. This is a wonderful period of the period of enlightenment, 18th century. Of course, I think this changed the way we were coming into our own as a fraternal order. And this is the period of the Industrial Revolution, 1760 to 1850. That period was followed by Romanticism, a period that is just, I think, so beautiful. When the writings of men about each other seem odd to us today because they seem to gush with this emotion that I was enraptured when my friend came through the door. I could think of nothing else but ways to please him. This was a way of embellishing the sense of respect and the importance of the relationship. Romanticism, the triumph of imagination and individuality. This is the period of Caspar, Friedrich, Garrochot, Delacroix, Turner, and Benjamin West. This is the period of the American Revolution, 1775 to 1783, and the French Revolution that followed, 1789 to 1799. And Napoleon was crowned Emperor of France, 1803. Now, did he crown himself? Anyway. We follow that period with a period called Realism, 1848 to 1900. Of course, these periods, this intellect influenced the gentle craft. Of course. How could it not? Realism, celebrating the working class and peasants. En plein air, rustic painting, Corot, Courbet, Daumier, and Millet. This is the European Democratic Revolutions of 1848. Then we get into the Impressionism. Ah, do I have it? I don't have anything hanging on the wall in this room. My favorite period, Impressionism. It's like when you squint and you have this impression of what's there. All the emotion captured, the color, the blending. So we don't see each little digit. We see what's created within this composite, capturing fleeting effects of natural light. You change your head, you put your head down, the lighting changes. Those special moments that only last for that second and then linger in the mind. Monet, Manet, Renoir, Passaro, Cazet, Morisot, Degas, the old man. This is also the period of Franco-Prussian War. 1870 to 1871, and the unification of Germany in 1871 from the principalities. Of course, then humanity moved into post-impressionism in 1885 to 1910, a soft revolt against impressionism. This was Van Gogh and Gauguin and Cézanne and Seurat. The Belle Epoque of the late 19th century of the Golden Age in Japan defeated Russia in 1905. Fauvism and Expressionism followed that, 1900 to 1935. This was the period leading up to, of course, more harsh colors and flat surfaces. Fauvism, emotion, distorting form, This is Matisse and Kirchner and Kandinsky and Marx. This is the period of the Boxer Rebellion in China, 1900. And of course, World War, 1914 to 1918. Cubism, Futurism, Suprematism, Constructivism, and the Siege, 1905 to 1920. This is pre- and post-World War I art experiments in new forms of to express modern life. This is where we began to explore and push out from the inner workings of the mind. Picasso, Braque, Leger, Boccioni, Silverini, and Malevich. This is the Russian Revolution in 1917. And American women were franchised in 1920. The vote. The vote. Dada and Surrealism. I think Canadian women had it first, didn't they? Yeah. Dada and Surrealism followed that in 1917, right up to 1950. This is ridiculous art, painting dreams and exploring the unconscious. Ridiculous in the sense of perhaps life down a rabbit hole, Alice in Wonderland, or the battles of the big Andes and little Andes and the Lilliputians. Duchamp and Dali, Ernst and Marguerite, the Tirico and the Kahlo, and disillusionment after the First World War occurred. And the Great Depression, 1929 to 1938, and the Second World War, the slaughter, right? 1939 to 1945, and the Nazi horrors, the atomic, never mind. That's something that has to be remembered, but what a disgrace. I don't know. Somehow lowered humanity that we were able to justify that. Lowered the expression of humanness when that happened. Sad. Sad. I hope we can't brag about that. I hope history is lets us make that a footnote. But abstract expressionism, 1940 to 1950, and pop art in the 1960s. The post-World War II, pure abstractionism and expression without form, popular art absorbs consumerism. This is Gorky and Pollock, de Kooning and Gothko and Warhol and Lichtenstein. The Cold War and Vietnam War. The U.S. entered that in 1965. The USSR suppressed the Hungarian Revolt in 1956 and the Czechoslovakian Revolt in 1968. Postmodernism and deconstructionism, art without a center and reworking and mixing past styles from 1970 right up to this period. So this is the period of Gerhard Richter and Cindy Sherman and Anselm and Kiefer and Frank Gehry and Zaha Hadid, nuclear freeze movement. Cold War fizzles and communism collapses in Eastern Europe and USSR between 1989 and 1991. Art history, the history of the world through art. There was something beside the war going on, from the earliest cave paintings up until what we have today. How do we separate it out? We don't separate it out. And I think we must learn what we can and move on so that our mistakes aren't repeated. Enough said. This isn't the kind of show where I sit and want to wear a hair shirt. No. Life is what it is. And it's the influence that we bring and bear. Part of what I want to talk to you about today. Some stuff that I've noticed. And I need your help with this. I've noticed that we seem to have been developed. We seem to struggle as Freemasons. I listen to, I sit quietly and listen to a Grand Master talking about his concerns, his genuine worries. And I appreciate that what the experience, I'm always concerned about or curious about what the experience does to the man's thinking. What does he learn from that that responsibility? That is an uncommon responsibility. And so it's not so much, it's more the pastiche. I put these things together in my mind and I get this image of what's going on. The concerns that we're losing, that we might lose risk some of the magic and mystique and mystery that makes us what we are. Well, I think that's legitimate. I think that's a legitimate. We don't want to risk that. I think mystery is important. It gives us a certain currency. And it's not something that we play on or we do as clever little boys sitting around a table saying, oh, let's be mysterious because it'll have some value. It's like, gee, it's what we are historically. I want you to think about us as a group of people that are contemplative. We're not gregarious by nature. The appeal of Freemasonry is to the contemplative mind. I think this begins, if you bear with me, to explain not the where we've gone wrong, but what's happened. You know that I've spoken to you last week and the week before about Walter Leslie Wilmshurst. Walter Wally, and I would, you know, wherever you are, Wally, there's some questions I want to put to you, you rascal. Very, very thoughtful man. And he talked with us, he writes about this shift that we seem over the centuries to have shifted away from one of the three principles of the order, brotherly love, relief, and truth. The three, no secrets. But his concern was that we seem to have focused on the first two at the expense of the last. Now, immediately this suggests to me imbalance. My view of the world of Freemasonry is not a hierarchy. This isn't about family first, job second, Masonry third. Although I've heard Wags talk about that. Family first, job second, Masonry third. It's about, like anything else, it's a balance. Life isn't about necessarily priorities. It's about balance from a Masonic perspective. Isn't that what the arch is about? Isn't that what the metaphor of architecture is about? Bringing together ideas to form balance? Well, okay. Mea culpa. There you go. So if you feel that the world is about priorities, go ahead. But we are talking about you and I as spiritual creatures. Whereas is that like the lesser priority today? Well, it's not like, well, what's important is today, family's important, jobs are important. There's lots of things that are important in the moment. Are you asking me in the moment, do I have priorities? Well, right now I'm going to talk with you. Does that mean everything else is of less priority? No. It's balance. Balance. In the mature mind, we have to be able to have competing ideas that hold them in our minds without feeling that we're ridiculous. It's absolutely essential. The only way we can progress is if you and I can be diametrically opposed in a position and I can begin to learn from your position. To see the world through the eyes of another person is enormously important. I know I keep hearing people that are walking around with that sense of self-importance based on their accomplishments. I just don't get it. What in the world has Freemasonry done? Is this about self-importance? We came, the roots of Freemasonry were formed in a period when moral and character development were on the minds of intelligent men. Today, you and I exist in a different world. We live in a world of celebrity. And what often happens is we even mock the moral decline of celebrity. Some young starlet does something tragic in her life. We put it on television and laugh about her. That's not right. That's not right. We have an actress that commits suicide because she can't handle the pressure. It's not right that I should, that's entertainment. That's sad. Be honest with you. But in a day of celebrity, we look at world leaders that fall because of human characteristics, human traits. They're imperfect. Religious leaders. Is there a leader that a form of celebrity that hasn't been stained in some way? Well, no. It doesn't necessarily give me or anybody else a moral high ground by saying, oh my goodness, we do it all the time. Well, of course, if I listen to some of the older people around with their, you know, teeth clenching cynicism, they can easily cite a list of examples. But doesn't make it so. Doesn't make it so. It's because celebrity has replaced character development. The disappointment isn't that, you know, this leader has, you know, not had solutions to big problems. It's that the disappointment is in the eye of the beholder that the character and the moral development of the person is somehow faulted. Well, we really have strayed from what Walter Leslie was talking about. He's talking about our focus on brotherly love, the fraternal socialism, the glad handing, back slapping, ha ha, great to be together. Yeah. And we focus on the second, relief, charity. I've talked about, shaking my head, that we're 46,000, 43,000 middle managers, all, you know, salivating over the money counters. What are we doing with it? Where is it going? Yes, it's important. Of course it's important. But it doesn't define what we are. I'm sorry. Not that alone. Never did, never will, except in minds of a few meager people, I think. I'll say that out loud. Did I say that? Oh no, that was a silent thought. Except it's true. He was talking about the last one, truth. Truth. The ethics, the spirituality of the order. The first time I read through Brother Wildenhurst's material, I thought, geez, man has complaints. If I could only sit down with him, I could convince him that there was more happening, that he was seeing something that was absolutely essential and necessary for us to be able to struggle with and then move forward. The sort of the counterpoint, the atonement. We need to have that. So what do we atone for? The loss of our spiritual sense of balance with spirituality. Well, you're hearing it here a second. Wally was right. I agree with him. We have struck. He was talking about us having strayed for centuries. And yeah, here we are in the 21st century. And sir, I agree with you. But it's not that simple. It's not like we're silly. Put your pointy finger back in your holster there, brethren. This is about a way of thinking. Our culture, the secular world, does not necessarily make us better people. We ran away from the problems of authorities trying to define the world, and we found that that was horrible. It was horrible because it was suffocating to the human condition. Totalitarianism never worked. Time and time again, and we're seeing some young fellow, 29-year-old, over in a peninsula over in the eastern part of the world, trying it again. All right, Rivoli's canon. The period in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries was a period of character development. The lessons were about ethics and moral development. And a lot of our reading, the material that we have around us, is talking about moral development, the things that, the a way of thinking. I want to talk to the, you know, one day, I'll get back to the boys that I owe them, the boys with the, when you're looking at leadership development, there is that je ne sais quoi. My goodness, what is it about that, you know, all right, Freemasonry offers a lot of training. To become a Freemason, we have to tell you what to do, when you, how to square something and how to, you know, show respect in certain places. So we have to be taught that. We don't know that by osmosis. But with character development, the part of that makes a good man better, that's telling you by example. You have to figure that out. You have to, the man, the individual, the woman, the person, the child, has to figure that out. But it's not like we throw you in a dark forest. And that's what Freemasonry, I think that's what Walter Leslie was talking about. And that's, we throw our candidates into the darkness of the forest and say, here, develop yourself morally. But we're not going to emphasize that. By the way, for the past couple of centuries, we've tended to ignore that. We focused on the things that are more evident. When we get together, we can have a drink and a sandwich and a good time. Well, that's pretty evident. We can open our eyes and see that. And we want to do something to help people that are in dire straits. Do some research. Something might not be popular, but it's really important. Well, yeah, that's perfect. That makes perfect sense. A common good. Well, boys, we're going to need to raise a few dollars to do that. Well, you know, the fellows that are so good at the shrine, they just, you know, they're remarkable. They enjoy and they produce. They are, you know, they are the real deal. They're wonderful. And it makes, and it's what they do inspires us. But the third, well, we can't really see that, can we? We can't really count it. We can't really teach it. So how do we go about the process of moral and character development? Well, that's a question that I've not heard, and I'm putting it to you. And yes, of course, I've got answers because I can win this argument. It's the only time in my entire day when I can win an argument until, and it's only temporary, until I run into you and you point out, ah, no, you're wrong again there. Great. All right. So let me enjoy this moment. It's hard. This is hard. We can, the way we teach this, brethren, is by example. And I don't mean some pious, buttoned-up prig. I don't mean that. That's not character development. That's just that's something unpleasant. That I'm sure their parents makes their parents feel proud. No, this isn't a competition. This is the real deal. What does it take? Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about, I think the way we do that is we have to illustrate. Oh, pardon me. That's a great architect's way of punishing me for getting uppity there. I got it. She's right again. We don't just do it by saying, well, watch me. I'm a man of character and moral development, so watch me and fake how you do it. No. We know when a person has character, but we don't know how to teach that and how to bring that out. So we have to go back in history, back in time. And it's not like these lessons aren't with us today, but we're not looking for them. Remember, we're under a lot of pressure, the competition to be better because we have more. And we know that that's false, that's empty. Or don't we? If you don't know that, then then what I'm saying will make absolutely no sense, and I apologize. But I want to talk to you about character development, what it is. It's the mental and moral qualities distinctive in an individual. This is where, you know, you've heard the likes of me talk about Freemasonry being instinctive and natural. This isn't something this isn't a political movement. It would have faded because, my God, we can't keep our mouths shut. If you want to know any of the secrets, just hang around one of the old boys or one of the new boys. Or, you know, it's not hard. They'll tell you. The giddiness that's out there, the giggle fest that's happened, the immaturity, it's all part of us. So, like, we're real. It's not like we're a bunch of funeral directors going about our business until the doors close and we can sit back and put our feet up and watch the hockey game. Character, complex of mental and ethical traits. It's what we are. Ethics, hey? And it's, so we first have to, I think, talk about and illustrate what it is that develops character. Because if we just point out, puff up my chest and say, here, this is about making you better, is about character development. Go figure that out. Well, no. We've been doing, this is about an ethical existence. At its simplest, ethics is a system of moral principles. They affect how people make decisions and lead their lives. Ethics is concerned with what is good for individuals and society, and is also described as moral philosophy. The term is derived from the Greek word ethos, which can mean custom or habit or character or disposition. So we need to be able to understand what these things are. Ethics covers dilemmas, like how to live a good life. You've heard the Masonic Home Companion started with that, didn't it? 3 years ago, on the 15th century Frenchman talking to us about that. Maybe we'll bring that back. It also covers our rights and responsibilities. And ethics is about the language of right and wrong. The language of right and wrong. Not the words, the language. And about moral decisions. What is good and what is bad. Our concepts of ethics have been derived from religions and philosophies and cultures. And they infuse debates on topics like abortion and human rights and professional conduct. Of course, philosophers nowadays tend to divide ethical theories into three areas: meta-ethics, normative ethics, and applied ethics. So meta-ethics deals with the nature of moral judgment. It looks at the origins and meanings of ethical principles. Normative ethics is concerned with the content of moral judgments and the criteria for what is right or wrong. And applied ethics looks at controversial topics like war, animal rights, and capital punishment. But for us, what use is it? If ethical theories are to be useful in practice, they need to affect the way we behave. If ethical theories are to be useful, they need to affect us. Some philosophers think that ethics does this. They argue that if a person realizes that it would be morally good to do something, then it would be irrational for that person not to do it. But human beings often behave irrationally. They follow their gut instinct even when their head suggests a different course of action. Ethics does provide good tools for thinking about moral issues. Now, we don't have these kind of lessons. The courses that we teach, the way we talk, we don't talk about this stuff. This slide, again, Wilmshurst hit it right. He's given a stick. There is a moral map that can be provided by ethics. Most moral issues get us pretty worked up thinking about, you know, euthanasia. And there's such emotional issues that we often let our hearts do the arguing while our brains go with the, you know, Freemasonry is for the contemplative mind. We are taught or expected to control our emotion. So when you see somebody pop up and they're having a rant, recognize that this is a person that hasn't developed that control. When we often find that a really poorly thought through idea covered by a bit of temper or impatience, recognize it for what it is. If the point had some merit, you wouldn't have to act ridiculous or try and out yell everybody in the bloody room, or insist at this point that you capture the attention of everybody. Weak, weak, weak. Signs of weakness we're covering up. It wants to ask us ethically, it wants to ask us if there's another way of tackling these issues rather than just what makes us feel good. Oh, I feel that's terrible, so I'm going to say it very loudly and get very upset about it. Well, the problem with that is that our emotion, especially our tempers, are temporary. And then what do you have? We do something in haste based on an emotionally developed decision. And when the emotion subsides, what do we have? Us having to scramble to justify something that doesn't make any sense. Huh? Well, I make no apology to anybody. Freemasonry does not continue based on that kind of thinking. This notion of popularity because it feels good, because I like it. Anybody that disagrees is wrong, and I'll be very upset. That's corrosive. That's corrosive to the philosophy of Freemasonry. It's corrosive to our order. But there's a reason, and there's something that can be done. We have not been fair with us. We have not been fair to ourselves in recognizing that the importance of the spiritual, moral, and character development. And so we have the petty peaks and quarrels going on between two fellows that, you know, if they looked at it with a bit of, could look at their position, you know, if we expected these people to say, look at it from the other guy's point of view first, and then you put your petition before me. And then till you can do that, you go away. Go in your man cave and have a good sulk and, you know, stomp your feet, have a little temper tantrum, and when you're done with all that, you come out. Because you're acting silly and you're embarrassing us all. When we get into these things, it makes us all look like fools. All. People don't walk away and say, oh, it was Graham that was doing it. People walk away and say, that was a Mason that did that. Oh, horror. Ethics doesn't seem to know the right answer to moral problems. Doesn't always. More and more people think that for many ethical issues, there isn't a single right answer, just a set of principles that can be applied to particular cases to give those involved some clear choices. Some philosophers go further and say that all ethics can do is eliminate confusion and clarify the issues. After that, it's up to each individual to come to their own conclusions. You can, I think, see why it's important for us to have a firm understanding of Masonic principles. And the scholarship in that regard is, we're surfing over the surface of that one, boys. And we know it. Oh, the dirty little secrets here I'm bringing up here. No, this is not a dirty little secret. This is the lament of Wally. Walter Leslie told us about this. What have we done about it? Well, you know how I was reading through the Book of Constitution and I noticed this stuff called Ancient Charges and noticed that we were instructed to read it every year. And then I remember one fellow saying, oh, well, we do that. We have an abbreviation. That's enough way you have to do that. You know, jeez. Now it's the state of what we've become. Surf through it all. Do the minimal. Anything to do with thought, well, that's boring. We don't have to do that. Give me the remote control, so for Masonic remote control, so I can fast forward all of this kind of discussion and just get to the good part where we can eat and make things simple. Because after all, it's all about making me happy, isn't it? Yeah. Sad state of affairs. For others, moral ambiguity is difficult because it forces them to take responsibility for their own choices and actions rather than falling back on convenient rules and customs. Ethics is about other people. It's a concern about something or someone other than ourselves and our own desires and self-interest. The subtext on this is, if we're not like this, then we probably are more selfish than we care to admit. Selfish in terms of self-serving. Ethics is concerned with other people's interests, with the interests of society, that greater good. That's the greatness of Freemasonry, with the great architect's interests, with ultimate goods, and so on. It's not just the language. It's not just words. It's like understanding what this is piecing together. That's why I think we've strayed. It's not that we're less. This has always been a challenge. And not everybody has the merit or capability or the skills to do this. It's not easy. It's why we have initiations that select a few people who say that they want this. What gives us the right to perform to express and develop the three principles? Well, each of us said we were willing. Wow. As a matter of fact, we've repeatedly given our word that we would follow the established practices and ancient customs, didn't we? Oh, were we supposed to forget that part because it's not convenient? Discussions of virtue and ethics is not convenient because, well, this isn't like a, you know. Take a look at the big picture. There's a lot of Freemasonry that has shifted a focus and been influenced by the culture that we live in. Why bring this up? Well, it's how we develop character. We begin by talking, communicating an idea. And the principles are for the greater good, for the common purpose of Freemasonry. Well, those are the principles, but they don't give us the answers. That's where we need to be able to talk out loud about ethics. It's not about the morality of particular courses of action, but it's also about the goodness of Freemasons and us and what it means to live a good life. At times in the past, some people thought that ethical problems could be solved in either discovering what God wanted people to do or thinking rigorously about moral principles and problems. So we try to divide it. If a person did this properly, they would lead to the right conclusion. But where'd that get us? If we live according to these ways, it doesn't work, does it? Now even philosophers are less sure that it's possible to devise a satisfactory and complete theory of ethics, at least not one that leads to conclusions. So today, I think we have evolved, and I think we are progressive. We are learning. We have more history today and greater accuracy than we did 200 years ago. We know more. Oh, is that just too much to jam into our little head? We want to go back to a simpler time because when we grow up and we have a sense of responsibility for understanding that we see the world as it really is, we take off the rose-colored glasses, well, we've grown up. The promises of childhood fall apart because life is not a big happy joke. It's not about being the fastest runner or the best at maths. Living a good life requires more than that. Effort. We experience tragedy and hardship, and it starts to define us as people. Well, we've had setbacks and failures. We have to learn. The character is not whether we fail or not, but what we learn from it, how we adapt, how we learn and progress and move on. Even when we are discouraged. And if you've not felt that, you've been living in a paradise, a fool's paradise. Philosophy can help identify the range of ethical methods and conversations and value systems. It can be applied to a particular problem. But after that, these things have been made clear. After they've been made, each person must make their own decision and then react appropriately to the consequence. Only by knowing this can we see that, recognize when another fellow is doing just that. On the face of it, this kind of realism means the view that moral qualities such as wrongness and likewise moral facts such as the fact that an act is wrong exist in return naturally. So that if one says that a certain act was wrong, one is saying that there existed somehow, somewhere, this quality of wrongness, and that it had to exist there if that act were to be wrong. Interesting, eh? So, I give you four ethical isms, and then I think we have to move on, don't we? I think it's important, and I think the answer, I think, you know, help me here. Is it, am I losing it? Is the answer to a lot of what we, you know, that expectation. We have this sense of Freemasonry with this enormous, puts this enormous stage in front of us and creates this expectation that shrinks us into the sense of humility. We might ask a statement. We can show that they're here. I'll leave you with just a few of these things. I might be making a statement about an ethical fact. Is it wrong to murder? This is moral realism. I might be making a statement about my own feelings. I disapprove of murder. This is subjectivism. I might be expressing my feelings. Down with murder. This is emotivism. I might be giving an instruction or a prohibition. Don't murder people. This is prescriptivism. Moral realism is based on the idea that there are real objective moral facts or truths in the universe. Moral statements provide factual information about these truths. Subjectivism teaches that moral judgments are nothing more than statements of a person's feelings or attitudes, and that ethical statements do not contain factual truths about goodness or badness. Subjectivists say that moral statements are statements about the feelings, attitudes, and emotions that a particular person or group has about a particular issue. If a person says something is good or bad, they're telling us about the positive or negative feelings that they have about this subject. So if somebody says murder is wrong, they're telling us that they disapprove of murder. These statements are true if that person does hold that appropriate attitude or have the appropriate feelings. They are false if the person doesn't. Emotivism is the view that moral claims are no more than expressions of approval or disapproval. It sounds a little bit like subjectivism, but in emotivism, a moral statement doesn't provide information about the speaker's feelings about the topic, but expresses those feelings. When an emotivist says murder is wrong, it's like saying down with murder or murder, yuck, or just saying murder while pulling a horrified face or, you know, thumbs down or no way, no way. So when somebody makes a moral judgment, they show their feelings about something. Some theorists suggest that in expressing a feeling, the person gives an instruction to others about how to act toward the subject matter. Prescriptivists think that ethical statements are instructions or recommendations. So if I say something is good, I'm recommending you to do it. And if I say something is bad, I'm telling you not to do it. So when somebody comes out, I disagree. Oh, you're paranoid. Okay. So when the people do this, you know, and whether you agree with it or not, they are expressing their mindset. Prescriptivists, emotivists, subjectivists, right? Or, you know, prescriptivism, emotivism, subjectivism, and moral realism. Saying there's one way, you know, moral realism. There's one answer, and this is it, and don't, you know, we're not going to discuss it. They're telling us about their form of ism. They're telling us they're expressing their understanding, their ethical sense. Is that the only one? Well, obviously, we're just breaking this down into four subtypes. So Is it because they haven't taken a look at it or had this discussion? My goodness, how could they possibly miss this episode of Masonic Home Companion? Well, of course they're not going to pick up on it. So where does this all come from? There's almost always a prescriptive element in any real-world ethical statement. Any ethical statement can be reworked with a little bit of effort into a statement about what it and ought. Lying is wrong can be written as people ought not to tell lies. Where does the ethics come from? The wizards, the philosophers tell us that, God and religion. Or human conscience and intuition. Or a rational moral cost-benefit analysis of actions and their effects. It's going to get us further. Or the example of good human beings. Or a desire for the best for people in each unique situation. Or political power. God-based ethics, supernaturalism it's called, makes ethics inseparable from religion. It teaches that the only source of moral rules is God. So something is good because God says it is, and the way to lead a good life is to do what God wants. Okay, that's supernaturalism. Don't get your shorts in a wad. Turn down your hearing aid if this is a little too much. Turn up your pacemaker, or it's going to get exciting here. Intuitionism, think that good and bad are real objective properties that can't be broken down into component parts. They're real and they're objective. Something is good because it's good. Its goodness doesn't need justifying or proving. I want to call this Masonic pate. It's like, with pate, you have to savor little bits on a cracker. You don't want to sit down and make a meal on it. Do this. Take away one of these things and sit down and just do it symbolically. Here, I'll help you with the symbols. Get a nice glass of wine or sparkling water, a nice glass of Avia or Perrier. Put on some music that really has a nice effect on you. Here, I use Baroque music. I don't know why it just hits that chord. Find that and take up one of these and savor it. So good things are the things that a sensible person realizes are good if they spend some time pondering the subject. This is intuitionism. For the intuitionists, moral truths are not discovered by a rational argument. Moral truths are not discovered by having a hunch or by having a feeling. It's more a sort of moral aha. Yeah, get it. Consequentialism, this is the ethical theory that most non-religious people think they use every day. It bases morality on the consequences of human actions and not on the actions themselves. Consequentialism teaches that people should do whatever produces the great amount of good consequences. One famous way of putting this is the greatest good for the greatest number of people. We've heard that. The common good, greatest good for the greatest number. Despite its obvious common sense appeal, consequentialism turns out to be a complicated theory and doesn't provide a complete solution for all ethical problems. There are two problems with it that are obvious. It can lead to the conclusion that some quite dreadful acts are good. And predicting and evaluating the consequences of actions is often very difficult. I'm thinking of the first one. Example is slavery. If we all agree that it's, oh my goodness, consequentialism, subjugation of women. I think this is non-consequentialism deontological ethics. Deontological. There's a word that'll make mom proud. Non-consequentialism is concerned with the actions themselves and not with the consequences. It's the theory that people are using when they refer to the principle of the thing. It teaches that some acts are right or wrong in themselves, whatever the consequence, and people should act accordingly. Virtue ethics looks at virtue or moral character, rather than at ethical duties and rules, or the consequences of actions. Indeed, some philosophers to this day deny that there can be such things as universal ethical rules. Virtue ethics is particularly concerned with the way individuals live their lives, and less concerned in assessing particular actions. It develops the idea of good actions by looking at the way virtuous people express their inner goodness in the things that they do. Remember, you are Freemasonry. You are the vessel. You are the temple. You are the arch. You are the angle. The rightness? Well, we've just increased the magnification on that one, haven't we? Let's just turn that up and put it under the Masonic microscope and take a look at what in the hell we are talking about here. The rightness. So, point your finger at me and tell me this is the way it is, and all of a sudden I have a sense of your ethics. But I also have a sense of the ethical options. So now, when you and I are looking at a breakdown of ethics, it's like we're looking at things more at the molecular level. So our brother is coming in and saying, that is permanent. That's the way it is. Well, the scientist is whispering in my ear that, damn, what you see is an impression. That what you see is not immovable. At a molecular level, everything is moving. And in fact, inside the molecules are atoms, and inside the atoms, there is more space than matter. So what I'm seeing is illusion. What I'm seeing is perspective. I'm seeing things that are in consistent ways that have something to do with processing information. But is he right? My brother saying, you know, everything around you is just static. Well, afraid not. But he has he's expressing a particular subjectivism. And that's all, the bee's knees of it all, isn't it? Being right, and what the right thing to do? Well, we have to have some discussions. Because I'd love to. You know, this is where I need your advice. I can't be fooling around with these things, sitting here in my own little, you know, bleak existence without having that dialogue. That fraternal, instinctive, natural connection is part of the value added of Freemasonry. Going in and slapping me on the back, saying, thank you, we've got attendance, therefore we must be doing something successful. Good, oh, man. And keep dressing up and come back and we'll encourage, you know, mediocre work and say it's wonderful. Well, no, I'm sorry. It is what it is. Mediocre work is mediocre work. That's not, and tolerance of it doesn't necessarily help address ethical or moral or characterological questions in development. But just like anybody else, I have my own sense of ethics, and you'll capture my viewpoint. I can't possibly be divorced from any one of these. It isn't a competition. This isn't easy. Are there universal moral rules? One of the big questions. Moral absolutism. Some people think that there are such universal rules that apply to everyone. This sort of thinking is called moral absolutism. And it argues that there are some moral rules that are always true, that these rules can be discovered and applied to everyone. And moral acts that break these moral rules are wrong in themselves, regardless of the circumstance or the consequences of those acts. Absolutism takes a universal view of humanity. There is one set of rules for everyone, which enables the drafting of universal rules, like the Declaration of Human Rights. religious views on ethics tend to be absolutist. Why people agree with moral absolutism? Many of us feel that the consequence of an act or the circumstances surrounding it are irrelevant to whether that act is good or bad. Absolutism doesn't fit with respect for diversity or tradition. Moral relativists say if you look at different cultures or different periods in history, you'll find that they have different moral rules. It makes sense to say that good refers to the things that a particular group of people approve of. Moral relativists think that that's just fine and dispute the idea that there are some objective and discoverable super rules that all cultures ought to obey. They believe that relativism respects the diversity of human societies and responds to the different circumstances surrounding human acts. Why people disagree with moral relativism? Many of us feel that moral rules have more to them than the general agreement of a group of people, that morality is more than a supercharged form of etiquette. Many of us think we can be good without conforming to the rules of society. Moral relativism is a problem with arguing against the majority view. Most people in a society agree with particular rules, that's the end of the matter. Many of the improvements in the world have come because people opposing the prevailing ethical view, moral relativists, are forced to regard such people as behaving badly. Any choice of social grouping as the foundation of ethics is bound to be arbitrary. Any choice of social grouping as the foundation of ethics is bound to be arbitrary. Moral relativism doesn't provide any way to deal with moral differences between societies. Moral somewhere in betweenism. Most non-philosophers think that both of the theories have some good points and think that there are a few absolute ethical rules, but a lot of ethical rules depend on the culture. Anyway, dig into this. Go to bbc.co.uk and look at ethics and introduction and ponder this as much as you care to, or come back and we'll talk. I always find this more interesting when we get a chance to hear each other. Who knew? Who knew that there are consequences and risks? Who knew that ethics is not simple? That pontificating a particular way of thinking is the only way? Who knew? Well, we do. We're looking at a bit of philosophy here, a little bit, a taste. It's different when you do that, isn't it? Always different when you know a little bit more about what's going on, huh? Henry David Thoreau, you know Henry David. He was a son of wealthy parents. You know, Walden, you know, that paradise in the mind. You cannot dream yourself into a character. You must hammer and forge yourself one. Do you know that? Nothing of character is really permanent but virtue and personal worth. Daniel Webster said that. I have to go. Character is like a tree, and reputation is like its shadow. The shadow is what we think of it. The tree is the real thing. It's been an absolute pleasure. I couldn't hold back. This was something that's been... I'll come back and talk more about spiritualism and character development, because I think it's important. I think it helps us to produce greatness in leadership and greatness in each one of us. We can't do it alone. Blog Talk Radio is getting me to sign off now. I hope you come back next week so we can talk again. In the meantime, commit random acts of Masonic kindness. Be kind to one another. And open a few books. Open your mind. See you soon. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.